Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Stay tuned for more of our debate on the future of humanity. In this program, we listen to the second half of a debate which was held on June 27th at Yale University, sponsored by the World Transhumanist Association, on the topic, Should Humans Accept or Reject the Path to the Post-Human? The debate was between Greg Stock, the director of the Medicine, Technology, and Society program at UCLA, and George Annis, the director of the Health Law program at Boston University. While Dr. Stock has argued that parents should have the right to choose the genes of their children in his book Redesigning Humans, Professor Annis has argued for an international treaty to make genetic interventions in children and cloning a crime against humanity.
Now, this is the hard part. What things would I prohibit by this international treaty? What things would the burden of proof be shifted on? And I used to use the phrase species-altering and species-endangering experiments. All right. I'm not quite sure I'm wrong about species altering yet, but I'll be conceived. It's very hard to figure out what the hell those are. What I'd say tonight is any species altering experiment that also is species endangering are the kind of things that I would outlaw. I'd outlaw essentially any species endangering experiment. Experiments that put the whole of humanity at risk. All right. So take an easy part. What things are okay to do? Anything you want to do to yourself, virtually anything you want to do to yourself, right? You want to redesign your body, go for it, right? We have some limits on maiming, mayhem, but very few. Basically, you can do whatever you want, right? Up till 2 days ago, we had a limit on what you could do in your bedroom. We don't have that anymore, all right? Even this Supreme Court says, consenting adults can do whatever the hell they want, all right? And that's right, and that's a really good rule. But as Justice Kennedy pointed out in that opinion, The court had been totally wrong in the history of sodomy in this country. It really wasn't about what two adults could do historically. It was about what adults could do to children, all right? And they had to have the sodomy law, so it wasn't just traditional vaginal intercourse that was illegal, right? When you did it with an unconsenting child. That's wrong, and any experiment that you do on your children or an unconsenting to other person outlaw. That's going to be species changing or significantly altering or dangerous, right? So I would not permit you to do any experiments, genetic engineering, on your kids. That should be up to them, right? Let them grow up and make their own minds, right? There's actually, brilliance too much of a word, but it's actually a terrific review in this month's Reason magazine by Michael Moses. He takes a look at the three great myth stories of our day. And opens with a very interesting thing. It says, children in the next 100 years, when they look back on the first 10 years of our century, probably will not remember the names Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and George W. Bush, but they will remember the names Harry Potter, Luke Skywalker, and Frodo Baggins. And I think that's right. You know, he talks about the power of these myths. And what these myths have done and how they're ingrained in our consciousness, and goes through how they're all essentially the same in the sense of a young boy, you know, breaking out of his home, finding his home really not raised but deeply thought, going out on an adventure, having powers that he didn't know, and fighting powers that he didn't know existed. And Darth Vader turns out, in Moses' view, and I think he's right, to be kind of the downside of the biotech future, right? The fusion of computer and flesh in kind of a horrible way. But what he concludes from all this is that we really are very ambivalent about the future, right? We want, and I think Greg really exemplifies this, what we want is freedom. We don't want any constraints. None of these bureaucrats from the UN. Nobody's going to tell me what to do, all right? But at the same time, we want the right to design our children, to produce other people the way we want to, through psychopharmacology or whatever. In Moses' view, we wish at once to be free and to be gods to others. And I think that's right. And I'm perfectly happy for you to be free. I'm not happy, and I don't think you should be happy either, to be a god to others, including your children. That would be tyranny over your children, and I think we should all resist tyranny. In terms of trying to actually fashion a global treaty, that's really not a non-trivial issue, right? It's very difficult. But it doesn't mean it can't be done, right? We've had all kinds of problems with our species, all kinds of problems with the United Nations. We don't, you know, we should remodel or reform the UN, and maybe we'll do that. But, you know, it's time to do that. I mean, Greg thinks that this is not like nuclear weapons. See, don't we wish this stuff wasn't like nuclear weapons? We even have a brand new phrase, right, NBD, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, all right? That's the reason we put those all together. They're all potentially catastrophic to the world. In terms of the international treaty, though, let me just say again that this is something that is supported by major scientists and major scientific groups. Eric Lander, one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project, has said, and I quote Eric, "For my own part, I would put an absolute ban on human germline gene therapy." All right? And he says, he goes on to say, "Not because I think we should never cross it, but right now, we should." There's no way that it would work. And just the finding of the Human Genome Project so far, we don't know exactly how many genes there are yet, but it looks like around 25 or 26,000, that they're about one quarter of what we thought, means that it is not true. The old doctrine is not true, right? That one gene, RNA makes DNA makes protein. Our DNA makes RNA makes protein. It's not true. Makes $1 billion. Craig said, actually, at this meeting as well, Craig Venter, that one of the an industry guy threatened to sue him when he said there were only 25,000 genes. He said, "I promised my investors a lot more genes than that." And the only point is, biology is much more complicated than we thought it was. And I think it makes a lot of sense, at least it does to me, to be prudent, to be cautious, to use the precautionary principle when we can put the entire species at risk, and as I would do, outlaw species endangering experiments while permitting individuals to do great freedom to experiment on themselves, experiment on consenting adults, but not to experiment on children or non-consenting adults. Thank you.
Well, it's really encouraging, George, to hear your acceptance of individual rights in these various realms. Because by your admission, I think that you would get rid of all drug law, drug enforcement laws, or the anti-drug policies of any, allow any anti-aging medicine to occur. Certainly psychopharmacology is something that an individual is doing to his or herself, so that's certainly fine. So the only area is the idea of what should be done, what rights sort of parents have to do things that might put their children at risk. And it feels to me that in that realm, first of all, we talk about this as though there's some huge industry of or group that's waiting and trying to do genetic engineering of children, and that's certainly not about to occur because there's nothing that really can be done at the present time. You'd have to have things that are worth doing and ways to do them reliably. Those don't exist yet. So I don't see any reason that you need a ban, much less a global ban on these sorts of things. You might get a few rogue scientists that would do a few things, but you know, we aren't rushing around trying to ban brain transplants. I mean, there aren't a lot of people that would do those. And I see the same thing as with the germline engineering, and I have a concern about biowarfare as well. The area that this idea of the precautionary principle, though, I mean, this is just a recipe for stasis. When you start trying to make people prove in advance, so it sounds like you're a man that really would like to see these sorts of technologies arrive, or is at least accepting that they would, and yet then you go and talk about the precautionary principle. Well, if you start making companies and individuals prove that what they're going to do is more likely to be good than harmful, that's an incredible barrier to any kind of work. And if we applied that in every other realm across the board, then nothing would occur. And you said, but what would you really try and stop? well, things that are species-altering or species-endangering. And yet most of the things, like the area of with children, you know, that certainly isn't species-endangering, and as far as being species-altering, that's very dubious as well. I mean, birth control is probably more species-altering than genetic engineering would be, and yet I don't think you want to ban birth control. So it seems to me that you use these sorts of umbrellas, like the precautionary principle or species alteration, that could cover all sorts of territory. And in fact, bringing politics, making political decisions about how to use these sorts of technology is what's really dangerous, because politics tends to be captured by the extremes, as you can see from the rejection of the Bush administration of efforts to have a global ban on cloning, because you won't also ban stem cell work. And so that's why I would like to see this not taken into, you know, the legislative realm, and certainly not global treaties that are expressed in these enormous generalities. We have a way of allowing individuals to make choices about these things, and that's the market. I mean, that's the way we tend to allocate resources and allow people to do these sorts of things. And you say, when I say this is not nuclear weapons, I don't mean maybe like bioterrorism, or some sort of viruses or something, but the kinds of, when you're talking about genetic engineering or anything of that sort, it really is not like nuclear weapons. If you really are worried about you and your family, just don't do it. And so finally, the space program you brought up. Yeah, you know, people's images of what would happen with the space program and where we were going to go and the next frontier, they were very naive, and where we would end up. And yet, the effects of the space program and all the technology that was brought to bear on that had enormous effects on us, not just changing the nature of war in the world today, but changing the way we communicate with one another. It makes possible the internet. It makes possible all the kinds of telecommunications possibilities. So I think that it'll probably be the same way with biotechnology, that many of our images about where this is going to take us are probably rather naive and will be looked at as such. But I think that all of the efforts and energy that would go into the research and developing these technologies will have all sorts of applications that are quite distant from those larger visions and will, by and large, be positive ones. And I think that the worst thing, the most dangerous thing that you're talking about is this precautionary principle notion, which I think is just hogwash, okay? And that, in fact, it is being used by all sorts of people who actually are very well aware that by applying the precautionary principle not only to research but into the environmental movement. Is that 1 minute or am I finished? Yes. Okay, to the environmental movement, they see this as a way to blockade research without actually admitting that that is what they want to do.
Five-minute response.
Yeah, I guess there weren't any questions there. But yeah, no, Greg's right. We did get Tang out of the space program. I'm sorry I didn't mention it. I forgot. I probably understated the genetic engineering stuff. So let me say that more, because that probably is a major area that we have a disagreement on, is whether you can genetically engineer your kids. Whether you'll ever be able to do that, I agree with Greg. It's very open to question. And certainly with what we know about genetics today, no chance. And whether parents will ever want to do it is highly open to question. I was at a conference at Boston University. A number of people here attended, so I can mention it. When Steven Pinker made the argument that he did not believe any parent, well, I don't know if any parent or most parents, would take any risks with their children with germline genetic engineering if they thought there was a downside, if they thought there was any risk that the kid might turn out not with an IQ of 200, but with an IQ of 80. You know, if there was a downside to the genetic engineering, it might not risk. Parents aren't going to do it, right? And I thought, you know, I mean, nobody knows that. That's speculative, but, you know, he's certainly an authority on psychology and what parents might or might not do. So it's not certainly not true that it's inevitable that parents are going to embrace experimental germline genetic engineering. And as an experiment, which I wouldn't permit, by the way, you're right, at least not until it was proven to be safe in maybe 20 generations of primates, what would an experiment entail? How many generations would it take before you could say it was safe and it was non-experimental? So, I mean, maybe I'm with Greg in one sense. You know, I really don't think it's going to work, so why should I worry about it? Well, because if it does work, I think you have to worry about that too. And even with, you know, 1 to 2% probability of something horribly bad happening, you do have to think about that. And what this is something other thinkers have thought about. I mean, H.G. Wells wrote about two subspecies of humans 100 years ago, as have most modern science fiction writers right up to today. The problem is that if genetic engineering works, ultimately, not everybody's going to do it, but a significant number of wealthy people will do it, that we have the potential to create not necessarily a separate species, but a group of super individuals, super smart, super wealthy, and super strong or whatever, who may then view us, the normals, as defective, subject to slavery, or even to killing, to genocide. And when we see them as a risk to us, we may kill them. And it's that prospect of genetic genocide that I think itself, as a human rights matter, justifies a ban on germline genetic engineering today. So I'm with Eric Lander on that, and I just give him a different reason. Hans Moravec, who's thought about this a lot when it comes to robots and using cybernetics to enhance humans, has said that he believes in the future that it's going to be fine to let people make themselves healthier, more beautiful, stronger, and more intelligent, and longer live. And so do I. Do it, you know, knock yourself out, right? But what he says, if you use machinery to enhance yourself and make yourself as powerful or as smart as a robot, he said the rest of humans could not tolerate you. To exceed the limits of humanity, he said, one must renounce legal standing as a human being, including the right to corporate police protection, to subsidized income, and to influence laws, and to reside on Earth. In return, one gets a severance payment sufficient to establish a comfortable space homestead and absolute freedom to make one's way in the cosmos. All right? So there are prices. Even people who deeply believe in this, as Hans does, understands there are prices. If we make people too dangerous to the rest of humanity, they will kill us, or at least be so dangerous to us that we're going to have to exile. He wouldn't outlaw it. I might outlaw it, by the way. He wouldn't. But he would outlaw them. He would send them into outer space.
Okay, thank you.
So it seems to me that now we're beginning to get down to it. In that, you know, you were saying before that you're so worried about, you know, parents doing things to their children because it would be, you know, dangerous for them, I sort of think. But, you know, you're as aware as I am that there are all sorts of things that parents do to their children that we don't intervene about, like, you know, alcohol abuse or something of that sort that has effect on future children. And, you know, it's really what will happen. And so that the reason you're activated by genetic engineering is what you see happening if it is successful. Because, as you just said, if it isn't, then it doesn't really matter very much. Are we going to kill these people or are they going to dominate us in some way? Well, first of all, the divisions are not going to be on lines of wealth, I don't believe. I think they'll be on philosophical lines, that people will begin to manifest their own philosophies in their biology. And so the last to use these sorts of technologies would be very wealthy countries like Germany, where they very much oppose these and are living with the specters of past of Nazism, or perhaps yourself. And the first to embrace these would probably be those who in the developing world and others who see life as a struggle and are very, very competitive. And it seems to me that if you're concerned about these sorts of disparities, I mean, first of all, you have to acknowledge that there are great disparities already that we seem to be able to deal with pretty well. And you better go against issues like anti-aging medicine, which even though a person does it on themselves, can create disparities as well. So there really are, I think that if it is the success, the divisions in humanity and the tensions that would be associated with that, there are already quite adequate divisions to cause groups of people to kill one another, and usually they're based on religion or some issue that is very, very difficult to resolve at all, and the things that have been present since the beginning, really, that... you know, then you would have to impose these broad sorts of bans on any kind of enhancement technology. Now, as far as enhancement itself in humans, what I think is most interesting is that people will be relatively risk-averse about these things, although some people more risk-averse than others, because, you know, for instance, with anti-aging medicine, you can't test this stuff out very successfully for long-term implications of it, but, you know, what are the consequences if you're getting, are the alternatives if you're getting older? I mean, that's why people will be willing to try out these sorts of things. And if you look at enhancement and things that challenge the sense of humanity and our species, although I think that is such a nebulous concept, I'm not worried about our species, I'm worried about us now. It's a very different sort of a thing. That if you look at enhancement, the way it's going to arrive first is going to be in animals with very short generation times, like laboratory animals like mice, where it's actually possible to do these things. So you'll get, if enhancement of humans is possible, where you can expand capabilities in ways that are really meaningful, then they're going to occur in animals first, and we're going to get animals with human-like traits, which will cause us every bit of the same kinds of problems in our visions of who we are.
Well, Greg, I think you just said it, and I finally found the difference between us. You said, I'm not worried about our species. Well, I am. I think our species is in deep trouble, but I think we can do some things about it. You know, and I think it's irresponsible for any scientist to say they're not worried about the species. They're just going to do their little scientific project, or they're just going to get their grant, or they just want to get tenure, or they just want to publish their paper. Certainly are welcome to that view, but I think that's a view that's not worthy of you or worthy of anyone who would call himself a scientist on the planet Earth today. There's just too much danger in the world, too much poverty, too much misery, too many problems in society with humans, not to be worried about the future, not to be worried about our current species, let alone the future of our species. Now, whether we could do anything about it is obviously a very, very difficult question. But the idea that it's going to be the first to embrace germline genetic engineering are going to be the people in the developing world. Are we both on planet Earth here? The people in the developing world don't have access to antibiotics today, for God's sake. They don't have access to malaria drugs. They don't have access to tuberculosis drugs. They don't have access to HIV drugs. But they're going to all of a sudden have access to germline genetic engineering? Excuse me, that's silly. You think the precautionary principle is silly? That's insane to think that. The developing world is going to be where the action is with germline genetic engineering. It is going to be the wealthy, and they are going to get not only wealthy, but strong, and whatever else happens when this works. Right? The question is, Martha Minow put the question in a couple of years ago, is how do you create a world in which difference is respected and not the grounds for extermination? That's the question that challenges all of us, it seems to me. I think we want a world of diversity. We want a world where individuals can be as different from each other as they want to be voluntarily, not to make their children different, themselves different, all right? Let consenting adults do what they want, live the lives they want, but don't let them have dominion over other people, arbitrary power and force over other people, including their children. The fact that some parents are alcoholic is hardly an argument in favor of letting other parents, who aren't, use germline genetic engineering to create their kids. All right? Creating your kids on a blueprint is a totally different experience than trying to bring out the best in the natural talents your children have with ballet lessons and piano lessons and all the other pretty awful things parents do to their children. It's that kind of tyranny that we do accept, but we have never accepted, and I don't think we ever should accept, the tyranny of actual manufacture. I'm not a big fan of Leon Cass, as any of you know who read my book review in JAMA 2 weeks ago, but Leon is right about commodification. If we let parents genetically design their kids become products, they do become commodified, and this does lead us down the brave new world to dehumanization. It's not transhumanism, it's dehumanism that we should worry about.
Concludes the second segment of this. Now we will open to questions from the floor.
I just wanted to try to point out where George missed the point in his last answer. So, first of all, with regard to the question of the of whether developing nations are going to be the first beneficiaries of these things, I think the whole point is that we've already seen exactly this in the development of drugs and in the development of, for example, genetically engineered crops, that it is in the interests of industry, which is having difficulty getting things developed in the US, which is risk-averse, relatively, to do that, to invest money, to basically loss lead in developing countries, get things going there and test them and make them safe there. And that is very likely indeed to happen in the future with more ambitious technologies as well. So I think that more or less turns that on its head. I'll stop there and come back later.
I got nothing against genetic modified crops, but the idea that the developing countries are the beneficiaries yet is silly, right? I mean, we just had the study in Europe that shows that Europe's subsidy of their agricultural products right now costs Africa tens of billions of dollars a year. I'm not opposed to genetically modified crops, and I would love to have the developing countries profit from this, but it's still... I mean, they are agricultural, so that makes some sense. But the idea that, you know, they're going to use germline genetic engineering makes no sense.
And the reason that I say that is that in polls that have been taken about whether parents would enhance their children physically or mentally, when these are done internationally, you get figures like 90% of people in Thailand and India that would say that they would do that, where the figures are much lower in the West, as low as 25% in Japan. So... clearly, it's not the peasant in the field, but that they're much more able to embrace these technologies on a philosophical basis, and there are lots and lots of affluent people in the developing world.
Back to my point, it's the rich who are going to do this. You agree then?
You've been listening to the second half of a debate which occurred June 27th, 2003 at Yale University as a part of the TransVision Conference sponsored by the World Transhumanist Association. The debate was on whether humans should accept or reject the path to the post-human, and the debate was between Greg Stock, the director of the Medicine, Society, and Technology Program at UCLA, and George Annis, the director of the Health Law Program at Boston University. To listen to the first half of this debate or other Change Surfer programs, you can go to changesurfer.com. To listen to other speeches that occurred at the TransVision Conference, or to find out more about the World Transhumanist Association, you can go to transhumanism.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.